Chapter 11. I put a half mile between us and the grinder. I could no longer see where it was. 100 fires gave the night sky a red hue. Randy coughed, and it sounded weak and pitiful. I jumped in the back. Randy and Royce lay where the back seat had been ripped away. The entire floor of the van was soaked in blood and glass. Randy moved as if to reach for me, but he stopped and grimaced in pain. Tears streamed down his cheek. Then, he said it.
"He's gone,"
he gasped the words wetly.
"Oh, God, I can't feel him anymore."
Then he whispered, gurgling,
"Royce, no."
Royce was dead. It took a long time for my brain to wrap around it. Royce, dead. My friend, gone. Just like that. Gone. This is my fault. If I hadn't come to their house.
"Don't move," I said. "I'm going to find another car. I'll take you to a hospital."
"Adam,"
he coughed, and blood came from his mouth.
"There's something I gotta confess. Royce thought we shouldn't tell you, but I think you need to know. It's about Niff."
"What do you mean?"
"She'd been coming over a lot lately. While you were at work. You know, just to hang out. Smoke some weed. Just innocent stuff. She was always asking us about being twins. Like, if we could feel each other's minds. Weird shit like that. It didn't make any sense until she told us about her dreams. And about your Niff's twins."
I didn't say anything. Too surprised to react. Other than me and the shrinks, I hadn't thought Niff had told anybody about her abortion or the nightmares. Royce and Randy? I didn't even think she liked them.
"Save your strength. This isn't important."
"No, it is. She came by that night last March. You know, before it happened. She was really upset."
"She did what?"
"Wait. She went to your house that night?"
"Yeah. She... she told us she was going to leave you. She was bawling hard. We didn't know what to do. She loves you, man. She said so and she meant it, but I don't know. She said she just couldn't take being with you anymore. She didn't elaborate. We thought she meant she was going to, you know, leave. It wasn't until a couple days later that we heard about what had happened."
I sat there, stunned. Niff had wanted to leave me. Back in rehab, she had said all sorts of stuff like that, but this was just 8 months ago. I had thought all of that was behind us. Randy continued, grappling with the words.
"Anyway, are you sure you want to do this? You can't save her. You can try, but you're going to get yourself killed."
"But I have to try. She called me. She begged for my help."
Randy nodded. He coughed, grimacing with pain. More blood came from his mouth. It was killing me just looking at him. Doing nothing.
"We've got to get you to a hospital. I'll find another car. Don't worry. You'll be okay."
"No."
He hissed, and I could barely hear him.
"He's gone. He's part of me. Don't you understand? I have to go too."
"Don't say that."
"It won't be long. I can feel it. It won't be long."
I put my hand on my friend's chest, and it felt as if I crunched down on a bag of potato chips. My friends were dead and dying. Nif had won it away from me. All the emotion of the last 10 minutes welled up in me and came out like a fire hydrant that had been creamed by a bus. I sobbed. Randy closed his eyes. Then he coughed.
Find Clementine. Find her. Tell her we sent you. She'll help you. But you gotta help her too. She won't want to leave. Make her. Please. Make sure you give her the duffel bag too. The one you carried, not the other one. Tell her we said goodbye.
You can tell her yourself.
But he couldn't. He was gone. I didn't have the stamina to carry both duffel bags far. I put the bag for Clementine over my shoulder and unzipped the other. It contained several magazines for the now-gone machine gun and another canister for my shotgun, along with a couple more boxes of shells. It also contained a bulletproof vest. I put it on. It was heavy, like the lead apron for when you get an X-ray. I imagined I looked ridiculous, like one of those guys you see all dressed up at comic book conventions, someone who would never be confused for an actual, real-life commando. I reloaded my shotgun and dumped the extra shells in the other bag. Inside it, there was a gas mask with replacement filters and another, smaller bag sealed with a zip tie. There was also a note that read, "Clementine." I opened the glove compartment of the van and I found a pen and a small pad of paper. I wrote a note and left it on the dash. To whomever finds this note, the grinder took the woman who owns this van. I think her baby may have been taken too. The body in the back are Royce and Randy Dominguez. They were my friends. Please treat them with respect. I didn't sign it. I tried to push the van to the side of the road, but I couldn't move it. I hoped after all of this was over, someone would find the note and then seek out the twins' parents and tell them that their sons were dead. I doubted I'd have the chance. I stepped into the street, bag over my shoulder, shotgun in my hands, and I jogged west, angling toward downtown. One benefit of this strange, unnatural attraction I now had with the grinder was that I could sense where it was relative to my position. It had changed direction, rolling east, which was away from where I needed to go. The further away it got, the less I could feel. I wondered about the grinder's foot soldiers. Before, like at the roller derby, one had to touch the beast to remain under its control. This new thing with the drones? This mind control? How did that work? Did they have to be close to it? Or would the control work wherever and whenever? I put my questions on pause and concentrated on my route. I would first have to pass where I was earlier. Arizona Stadium. It loomed in the distance, its visage forever burned in my mind, now as a giant tombstone. The road was jammed with discarded cars, all packed in so tightly they were useless to me. I remembered the woman who had abandoned her minivan in the street. I wondered how many of the people in these cars had run away, and how many had chased after the monster. I sometimes saw cars moving on the streets or a pair of candlelit eyes watching me suspiciously through curtains. But the roads were barren of people. As I jogged, I thought about everything that had just happened. It still didn't seem real. Nif had been captured. My best friends were gone. I had killed people. Several people. When I had woken up this morning, my biggest concern was finding the one type of ferret food that Hamlet wouldn't yak all over the living room floor. Nothing would be the same after this. No matter what happened. Nothing. And that freaked me out. Even if by some miracle I saved Nif, I knew she'd be destroyed mentally. She was already fragile, like one of those museum paintings that are so close to falling apart, they're behind glass and you can't even take a picture of them. All this pain and sacrifice. It couldn't be for nothing. I refused to believe it. After all our difficulties, after the drugs, after the long road to rehab, after that night last March when she tried to kill herself. Something had to come from it. Something. Nif was always looking for meaning, for purpose, for something bigger than herself. It's how she was. For that year after her graduation from rehab, she spent her time looking for answers. For the most part, I'd considered myself agnostic. If there was a god, I figured he probably wasn't anything like we imagined. Or we were like a forgotten toy buried somewhere in his closet. It wasn't one of those things that kept me up at night, but when I did think about it, I always remembered the old lady in the tadpoles.
"The Lord doesn't care about the beasts of this world,"
she had said, meaning the animals and bugs and the sort. But I reckoned it applied to us, too. It was the only explanation that made sense to me. Nif was an atheist when we met, but after her stint in rehab, after all those crazy nightmares pounded on her night after night, she began to question that lack of faith. She believed the dreams to be real. She believed her twins, our twins, burned in hell. It tore her up. She set out to find answers, to find solace. She found neither. She tried every faith imaginable. She talked to priests and rabbis. She went to the Baptist church down the street from our house. She read up on Scientology, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, other religions I never even heard of. None of it felt right to her.
"I'm doing something wrong,"
she told me one night, about a month before it happened.
"It shouldn't be so hard."
I didn't know how to respond. So I said nothing. She continued.
"Do you ever get scared when you're walking?"
"What do you mean?"
"You know, do you worry that when you take your next step, the ground won't really be there? Like it had been an illusion all along. And you've just been falling and falling and dreaming. And you're getting closer to the bottom of the pit every moment. And maybe at the very bottom of the pit, there's a hungry blender waiting for you."
She'd been saying weird shit like this a lot lately. I'd been just doing the smile and nod thing, but it was starting to frustrate me. And I didn't know what to do or say. "No. I've never felt that way." She looked at me with those impossible brown eyes.
"Why not?"
"Because when I take steps, I can usually see where the ground will be."
"That's what I want. I want to feel that."
A couple weeks later, I came home from work, and I found her in the bathtub with her wrists slit. I walked into the house, I put my stuff down, and I could just feel it hanging dense in the air. Something's wrong. Hamlet emerged from underneath the couch, looking sheepish. Nif rarely let him roam free by himself, otherwise he'd yank all the lamps off the tables and chew on the cable wire for the TV. People who say they've seen ghosts sometimes relate a feeling of cold, negative energy when they walk over a haunted patch. I never believed in any of that stuff, but that's exactly what I felt when I entered the house.
"Nif?"
The ferret hopped into the living room, ran in a few circles, and then headed down the hallway. He scratched at the door to the bathroom. I tried to open it, but it was locked.
"Nif?"
I called again. She didn't answer. I think my subconscious knew what was going on before I did. That oh-shit tingly feeling of panic washed over me. It wasn't unusual for me to come home and find Nif gone. It wasn't unusual for the bathroom door to be locked because the lock was a pain and often locked itself on your way out. But still, I knew something was off. I grabbed a butter knife from the kitchen and unlocked the door. Nif looked up at me from the bathtub. She moved languidly, naked and bathed in crimson.
"This is taking longer than I thought,"
she said. Hours later, while I sat in the hospital lobby, a woman in a buttoned-up pantsuit, a social worker or cop, I didn't even know, came out to talk to me. She introduced herself, but I didn't hear her. I was still in shock. I couldn't stop wondering what I had done wrong. Nif had told me all about this blender she was about to fall into, and I still hadn't been able to catch her.
"She'll be okay,"
the woman said.
Physically, at least. But she still isn't talking. Can you tell us what might have driven her to do this to herself?
I looked up. I don't know, I said. And I didn't. I told her about the dreams, about the search for meaning through all the churches. But it still made no sense to me. I was so confused. Nif spent a month in a mental hospital. I'd visit her whenever I could, and she acted normal, the same as before she'd tried to kill herself. Her new shrink, a bearded guy named Dr. Metcalf, had advised me not to ask her about it, so I didn't. But I couldn't stop wondering about what I had done wrong, what I could have done. So, one day I decided the doctor's advice was bullshit, and I asked her flat out, "What can I do? Tell me how I can fix it." She looked up at me and frowned.
"I'm not your Rubik's Cube,"
she said, and nothing more. She came home a few days later and we picked up where we left off. I didn't ask her again. She didn't bring it up. Cece and our other friends would come over and we'd sit and laugh and play video games and we'd all ignore the scars on Nif's wrists. A month later, she told me she found a church. She'd met a girl in the hospital and they'd kept contact on the outside. They met for lunch a few times and things spiraled after that. The Lambs of Redemption. I thought it sounded more like a metal band than a church. Nif said she went to a service and something just clicked in her mind, like a light switch being thrown. She asked me to go with her. I didn't want to, but I wanted to make her happy. So I went. This wasn't an incense and robes and stained glass window church. This was a rented conference room at the Holiday Inn where the Reverend wore polyester robes and shouted a lot and had three wives. The type of church you read about in Time after the fact. You know what I mean. A cult. A let's drink the Kool-Aid and put on brand new Nikes cult. A what the fuck are you thinking, Nif, cult. They believed some crazy shit. Stuff about planets and ancient aliens creating Jesus from monkey DNA mixed with their own. Our life was nothing but a 2D hologram projected on something or other. The Reverend was a dude named Cornelius Snow, a paunchy albino Elvis lookalike with oversized prescription sunglasses he wore even in the dark. He talked a lot about taxes and the government, but the overwhelming theme of the one sermon I attended was redemption. If you made a mistake, committed a sin, when you died, you weren't just forgiven your sins, you were taken to an alternate universe where your sins never occurred in the first place. But only if you had the key. I never found out what this metaphorical key was or what was required to obtain it, but I assumed it involved blowing up IRS buildings and providing oral sex to the good Reverend Snow. The service scared the crap out of me. I was afraid to tell Nif what I'd thought of it. She seemed finally at peace. At night, she slept more soundly. No nightmares. I feared if she felt I worked against her newfound faith, she'd push me away, and then there'd be nobody to protect her if this church went south. Luckily, Nif's enamor of the church lightened up over the next month. They tried to get her to leave me and to take her money. Something about a land purchase out in the middle of nowhere. Whatever hold they had on her thankfully gave way to reason. Still, she was different after that. Before she slit her wrists, she had desperately been looking for a spiritual way out from her nightmares and whatever else was going on with her. None of the solutions she sought worked. Deep down, I suspected she thought all the religions she tried were bullshit. Till this one church, the craziest of them all. I never understood how they were any different than any other church she tried. But after she left, all the crazy cult stuff went away, and the inner peace she had found appeared to remain. What also remained was a deep faith in a higher power. It wasn't the Christian or Muslim or Mormon or Wiccan or any other god of an organized religion. Whatever it was, it helped her. And for that, I was happy. But now, as I ran through the traffic jam on my way downtown, I wondered about the night I found her in the tub. I had assumed it was the dark depression that had fallen over her, and that had been caused by the nightmares and other post-drug addiction baggage. It never occurred to me that her problem wasn't that I hadn't been able to save her, that it was just me. But if I was her problem, why didn't she say anything? She acted like she loved me. She left me notes in my lunch for work. Usually they were stupid little sayings or quotes from a Ramones song, but they made me laugh. We had a whole lot of sex. When we slept, she wrapped her arms and legs around me. She told me all the time I was her best friend, and that I was the only person who kept her sane. I didn't understand.